pray with me and for me. Oh Lord, open our ears to hear and our hearts to receive your Spirit. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in thy sight, who alone is our rock and our redeemer. Amen. I guess if many of us were asked, what's the most important thing in your life, we'd say family. Families, in the best sense, are where we learn to love, where we are accepted, where we are nurtured, where we are taken in, even when we are alone. In The Death of the Hired Man, Robert Frost imagined someone saying, home is the place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in. I should have called it something you somehow haven't to deserve. That's our dream of family. It's a good dream, and it's a wonderful reality when it happens. Of course, we know that not all families are like this. Families are where we are meant to love, but where sadly sometimes there is violence. Sometimes there is oppression. Not all families accept each other. So many of the people I know have stories about being fearful about coming out about their true selves in their family. I know that in my own family, my mother held on to her grief and her anger and bitterness over a feeling that in the gendered values of her family, she had been treated as being less important than her brother. So families can be a mixed bag. And today we've heard Jesus say some shocking things about families. I'm here to set fathers against sons and daughters-in-law against mothers-in-law and all the rest. The word that's used there for sword actually just means sharp division. What does he possibly mean here? What does he intend us to get from this? We need to put these sayings in context, I think. And the most important part of context is that in the Roman world, family was very different than what it is here. In the Roman world, a family was a whole household of people, almost always headed by an older male. And that older male held absolute sway over all of the women in the household, his wife, his daughters, his daughter-in-laws, his sons, any other children that were there. And they often, in a well-to-do family, lived in a large compound. They also lived with slaves. They lived with other workers in the household. There might be over 100 people in this whole organization that was described as a family. What we think of as a family simply didn't exist. Roman religion and Jewish practice all centered on this pyramid of power. And so when Christian individuals began to worship, and when Christian individuals began to share in the teaching of Jesus, sometimes it caused conflict within their households, since that patriarchy was used to determining everything, including their religion. We know that near the end of the first century, there were many, many Christians who faced these sorts of family and household conflicts. I know a little bit about what that's like because in my own family, when I announced that I was going to be a minister, it was not received as a happy decision. I was asked, why don't you want to do something worthwhile with your life? So we know that in that pyramid of power household family, there were conflicts. And we know that everyone was expected to do as they were told, just because you were born into the family, because you were part of the family. There were no choices. Contrast this with Jesus. We hear almost nothing about his father, and he disregards his mother and brothers and sisters. They come at one point to get him because, frankly, they think he's crazy. And he looks at them, and then he looks around at all of the people that are assembled there, his friends, and he says, here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother. And you know, I know that feeling too. Years ago as a teenager, I went to camp on the shores of Lake Michigan every year, and I bonded with this group of campers. each year that bond became stronger. And so Saturday, we left on Sunday, we started then, and the next Saturday, parents would come to get us. And it was a terrible time, because all of a sudden, you weren't going to see your friends for another year. And I had the same feeling about my family. Here are my brothers and sisters, here in camp. What Jesus does is to assemble his own household, his own family. We know all about the 12 disciples, of course, but actually there was a much larger group that traveled with him. Luke says 70 or so. We know that there's a whole list of female disciples, women who provided for him, Joanna and Mary, and so on. There's a set of stories in John where he seems to be familiar with the household of Mary and Martha. And we know from a variety of sources that this is one of the things that Jesus was constantly criticized for. He eats with sinners. Well, sinners includes Gentiles, which is all of us. It includes women, which is many of us. It includes anyone who has a certain profession that puts you outside the pale. If you handle bodies, if you're an undertaker, if you handle meats, if you're any of a wide variety of things, if you don't follow the Talmud, the Jewish law, exactly, you're part of this broad, broad category of sinners. Also, in that time, there are lots and lots of skin lesions and little rashes and things that people get because they're living in not very sanitary conditions. And those are generically called lepers, and they're required to go outside the town and live separately. So there are lots of people being cast out from the community. And Jesus goes to them and assembles a household out of these people. He doesn't go to his own family. He goes out into the world, and he chooses them. You, 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 you come with me. Not everyone does. But enough to make a whole household. Now, Jesus is entirely realistic about how these people are going to be treated. If they call the master Beelzebul, which is a demonic figure, what are they going to call you? And his solution is give away being part of the family. Don't create boundaries. Don't create boundaries. Nothing is covered up, he says. All the things he's teaching them about love and forgiveness, none of that's covered up. None of it's a secret. There's nothing like a secret cult about Jesus. Nothing's secret. It's all going to be shared. It's all going to be shouted from the housetops. Everything is going to be revealed. And the important thing to understand about this is all invitation. Just before today's reading, Jesus has been teaching his disciples to go out and spread the good news of this new household. And this is their mission. This is our mission. This is what we're supposed to be doing. This is what we're required to do. I want you to think on the one hand about what we actually do, and then listen to this list. Okay. Cure the sick. Raise the dead. Cleanse the lepers. Cast out demons. Let me read this list again. Cure the sick. Raise the dead. Cleanse lepers. Cast out demons. You know, if you go through our whole newsletter over the past year, there's not one single dead person raised. At least we didn't take any pictures and Instagram that. The truth is, what Jesus is doing is bringing a radical kind of connected life into being. To cleanse the lepers is to go to someone and say, as he does, here, you're back in the community. You're back in the community. It's not about miraculous cures. It's about embracing those that are sick. I remember a number of years ago when the great wave of AIDS swept over us. I remember going to the hospital to see someone and simply putting out my hand and touching him and having him look at me and say, are you sure you want to do that? And I said, sure. Not because I was some hero, but just because that's what Jesus says we're supposed to do, is to gather people into us. He tells people that some people, some places aren't going to let you do this. And that's true. That's true. When I was first in the ministry, I mean, like, I'd been in my own first church 1 week. There I was, a lot thinner. And a man died, an older man in our church, or he was dying. He was in the process. And his wife asked me to come to the hospital and pray with him. So I got there in the ICU. And that was a different time when hospitals were much more closed. And the nurse said, well, you can't go in. It's family only. So I said in my best, not even ordained yet, just got called and moved to Seattle to be the pastor of the church there, voice, I'm his minister. She said, it doesn't matter. It's family only. So I went and found his wife in the waiting room, and I told her what they'd said and so on. And she said, that's terrible. I know he's just waiting. I know he just wants you to pray with him. Let me see what I can do. So she went over, and she got admitted, and then she held the door, and she snuck me in. Now, it's not the first time I ever broke a hospital rule, but it was the worst up to that point in my life. And so we went in this room, and I stood there over the man with her, and I didn't know what to do, and so I reached out to her, and I held her hand, and I reached over, and I held his hand, and I said, let's say the Lord's Prayer. And as I did that, that nurse came in there and saw me, and she said, what are you doing here? You can't be here. This is family only. And I looked at her, and I said, we are family. This is my brother in Christ. And she said, I'm going to call security. So I said, fine. And then she went off, and I said to Helen, I said, we got to pray fast. So we did. We prayed the Lord's Prayer fast. And about that time, a guy showed up, and he looked at me, and I said, I'm his minister, and we're praying. Would you like to join us? And the security guy said, I'll wait here. That's what we're supposed to do. That's what we're supposed to do. And, you know, not everybody's going to let us do it. I got thrown out of the ICU in that hospital. Not the last hospital I've been thrown out of. That's okay. You might get thrown out of somewhere. Just go on, Jesus says. Dust it off and go on. Even a member of your own family might oppose you. That's okay. Just go on. Why follow Jesus if he's going to cause such division and heartache? Because where we follow him is into a relationship with God that is so intimate and so particular that nothing else compares. He says, even the hairs of your head are numbered. Even the hairs of your head are numbered. Now, I want you to think about your hair for a moment, which is the first time I encountered this verse, I had a lot more than I do now. But even I have enough hair that it would be a project, wouldn't it? Can you imagine Jacqueline or somebody going through my hair? Can you imagine someone going through your hair and putting a little number tag on it? Wow, that would take forever, wouldn't it? Just little hair after hair after hair. Yeah, think about it. Think about trying to count your own hairs. That's how God knows us. Like someone who can actually sit there and count the hairs on your head. Even the woman who cuts my hair doesn't count them. She just cuts them off, right? Even the hairs on your head. That's how intimate God means to be with us. Now, that's how we find our life. We take time to let God be that intimate with us. This is what gives life. Jesus says, those who find their life will lose it. Those who lose their life for my sake will find it. It's not an easy way, because it isn't just about changing the world and changing politics and changing organizations and so on. It's about changing you. I used to work in another big old church years ago, and all big old churches struggle with the issue of cleaning. We're very fortunate here. We have a great person doing our cleaning. But in that church, we didn't, and we had struggled with some different people. And finally, we got a group called the Seabirds out of New London. The Seabirds are a wonderful group who take people who have Down syndrome and various other kinds of disabilities, and they bring them in as a crew. And instead of having one person clean your church, you have like 10 or 12 Seabirds. It's a great system because some of them can do some little thing, and they will do it with incredible devotion. We used to have a woman who could only sweep with a hand broom on the steps. And every day she would come and she would sweep 5 steps where you came into the church. That's all she could do. It would take her 3 hours. But she loved doing it. And we had the cleanest steps of any church in town. So among the Seabirds, the guy that I remember most was this guy who had some issues, some mental issues, some developmental issues. And in that particular church, I would often be going back and forth, and he would be there cleaning. And I was always in a hurry in those days. And he would say, "Tie shoe! Tie shoe!" And then he would laugh hysterically. Try this. It's not that funny, is it? Tie shoe! So, you know, I would kind of go, right, and then I would go off. And finally, I asked the supervisor, "Wait, what's the deal with tie shoe?" And he kind of laughed. He said, "Oh, he had a really hard time learning to tie his shoes. And so he often would wear them untied, and we had to watch him. And then someone would say, 'Oh, tie your shoe, tie your shoe.' And then he would laugh because he was embarrassed." And he said, "You know, I don't know if you realize this about yourself, but you often run around here with untied shoes." And I hadn't realized that. So it dawned on me what this guy was saying, what he was doing. It was a joke. So the next time he did it, I stopped, and I forced a laugh. You've done this, right? You've forced a laugh. "Tie shoe!" "Yes, I have to tie my shoes." "Thank you." So that went on for a little bit. And then we would talk a little bit, and I began to really enjoy him. And finally, one day it happened. I was healed. He said, "Tie shoe," and I laughed for real. You see, I had learned not to just hurry past him. What I'd really learned was that he was somebody whose God was numbering the hairs on his head, that God was loving and caring about and expecting me to do the same. It was me that had to change. This is what we are about, is healing people. You know, we talk a lot about growing this church, and I know we all love it when there's lots of people here. And I like that too. But nowhere does Jesus say we have to do that. We don't have to do that. We just have to raise dead people. In the old days, the 1950s, the way you did this was you found a place, there was going to be a new suburb, and you planted a church there, and then people just sort of naturally come. But, you know, I got to tell you, nobody's going to build a new suburb around here. So we can't use that model. Then there's the big mega church model. The way this works, the model for how this works, is a guy named Bill Hybels. And what Bill Hybels did was he went out to an area in Chicago where there weren't many churches, and he went around and he asked people what they wanted to hear. He didn't tell them about Jesus. He just said, "What would you like to hear?" And then he created a church where you can go to and you can hear what you want to hear instead of what Jesus says. Maybe that would work. I don't know. I've never done that. Because what I hear is that Jesus is sending us out. That he isn't about the number of people sitting in our pews. He's about the amount of love in our heart. That he isn't necessarily as concerned as we are about the institution as he is about the devotion of his household and his family. He doesn't say one word about getting a lot of people together. He says, "Go out and heal," and that's what we are meant to do. Most of the people who visit here, and the people that we are gathering into this household, this family of faith, they need some healing. A lot have been hurt somewhere else. Some are sick. Some come with scars. And they come here with a hope that we can offer something that will help them. And we can. Because at the center of Jesus' teaching is this passage. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. Two sparrows. That's the food of the poor. As I said, this is the common bird no one notices. This is the little bit of almost nothing that flits and isn't appreciated. And yet, isn't that just like a lot of people out there who so want a moment to share their story? This morning, Jacqueline and Ellen and May and John and I don't know, there was a little group, and Dave I think was there too. There was a whole little group out in front. And I love this, because to me this is exactly what Jesus does, this kind of stuff. It's sort of random. And a woman came over who'd been to his little sale. And she'd gotten a great bargain on a set of wrenches. So she opened it up and they all sort of spilled out. And you know, I couldn't help thinking as this was going on and everybody was oohing and aahing over these wrenches. Now, I know a lot of those people there have never used one of those kind of wrenches in their whole life. A lot of them, if you gave them a set of socket wrenches for their birthday, would go, oh, thank you. And already be thinking about regifting. They all acted like this was really special and wonderful that she had gotten this. And you know, the woman got a donut and then she went off. But when she left, she was smiling. You know, all of you who did that, Dave and Jacqueline and May and John, all of you, thank God. Because you're out there doing just what Jesus says. That was a little bit of her coming to life. I know it. I know it. Two sparrows don't fall to the ground without the Father. One of my favorite bands has a song called Small Swift Birds. It says, I have heard about the lives of small swift birds. They dazzle with their color and their deftness through the air. And then there's the day we look for them and we can't find them. These moments to heal, they come and then like a bubble, they burst. So they're precious. Don't miss them. Each of you is so precious to God, and so is everyone else. Jesus gathered us to share God's love, and he sends us out to heal God's people. This week, this month, every day, remember that you are on a mission from God to be the image of God's love. Amen.